Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 11-667, State v. Walton. Arguing for the petitioner, Richard Kawana. Arguing for the respondent, Stephen Tsushima. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, Mr. Kawana and Mr. Tsushima. Are you both ready to proceed today? Okay. Mr. Kawana, you've asked to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, so the yellow light will come on when you have 5 minutes to go, and Mr. Tsushima will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. Thank you very much. Mr. Kawana, please proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Richard Kawana, attorney for petitioner John Walton, who seeks relief from the decision of the Intermediate Court of Appeals, which affirmed his conviction for attempted murder in the second degree. The evidence presented by the state in this case was the offense occurred when Minh Van Tran, a taxi driver, picked up two men, Courage Elkshoulder and John Walton, as passengers in his taxi cab. Elkshoulder was seated directly behind Tran, the taxi driver, in the rear driver's side seat. Walton was seated in the rear passenger side seat. When they reached their destination, Tran was waiting to be paid. Tran was grabbed by Elkshoulder from behind, and his neck was stabbed on his right side. Tran testified it was Elkshoulder who stabbed him while Walton was still seated in the back. Tran never saw Walton with any knife in his hands. Now, despite the fact that the state's evidence pointed to Elkshoulder as the perpetrator.
Did he testify that he was held down by more than one person, though?
That's correct, Your Honor. But this was after the fact that, if Your Honor recalls from the record, when he was stabbed, blood spurted all over the place. He was obviously in a state of shock. Who knows how many hands held him down or did not hold him down. He thought he was being held down. But once again, the evidence is inconclusive because the last thing that he concretely remembered was the fact that Walton was seated in the rear passenger seat of the car. And that was his last clear recollection of what occurred, what he saw. So we would submit that this is one of those issues that is at best debatable, and certainly the only concrete evidence was the fact that it was Elkshoulder that he identified on numerous occasions as being the person who grabbed him from the back and he stabbed him. Not only did he make a statement to the detective when he was first interviewed, he gave a statement to his son, testified at the grand jury, testified at the trial. In all of those occasions, he stated that it was Elkshoulder who was the one that stabbed him.
But again, he did testify at trial that he could see both men holding him down. There was a point when he said there were three hands coming to pin him down while a fourth was trying to stab him.
Well, again, Your Honor, I think that is subject to debate as to whether or not that, in fact, was the case. And in any event, I think the gravamen of the issue is that it was Elkshoulder that did the actual stabbing, that did the actual, used the actual knife. Now, nevertheless, we would point out that it was, despite the evidence that was adduced, it was Elkshoulder who was convicted of the lesser included offense of assault that was merged into the robbery conviction, whereas Walton was the one that was actually convicted of attempted murder and robbery in the first degree that was merged into the attempted murder conviction. Now, we submit that this strange result, and we consider it strange because the evidence was so conclusively against the fact that Walton did the actual stabbing and should have taken the brunt of any conviction for attempted murder. This was because of a number of errors that the trial court made that denied Walton a fair trial, and I think that is the crux of the issue, that Walton was denied a fair trial. I would like to discuss each of these points in turn. First, the trial court, we believe, committed reversible error when it denied motions for severance by Walton both prior to and during the trial. Now, as the court knows, severance is required when the defenses of each defendant are in irreconcilable conflict with each other, and there is a significant danger that the conflict alone led the jury to infer guilt. Now, the facts clearly demonstrate these irreconcilable conflicts. On one hand, the evidence presented, including the testimony of the taxi driver, was that it was co-defendant Elchilder, the Asian-looking man sitting directly behind him, who grabbed Tran with his left arm and stabbed him repeatedly on the neck. And again, I emphasize, Tran was sure it was Elchilder, not Walter. Despite the actual eyewitness testimony of Mr. Tran, Elchilder, during the course of the trials, when he testified, said, "It wasn't me, it was Walton who attacked Tran. I had nothing to do with it. It was Walton who did everything." Again, this demonstrates how totally irreconcilable these two positions were. Second, Elchilder's testimony and the CD recording that he presented, which became an issue at trial, would not have been admissible or presented in a separate trial not involving Elchilder. If Walton had gone to trial by himself, the state already had its theory of the case. It was going to try to prove that Walton was an accomplice, that he didn't do the stabbing, it was really Elchilder that did the stabbing. He wouldn't have brought in Elchilder's, what he considered to be suspect, CD recording.
The state argues that it's not inevitable that Elchilder would not have appeared at Walton's trial if Walton were tried separately.
I guess anything is possible, Your Honor, but given the reality of the situation, would Elchilder, who was being tried separately, take the stand in this case and said, "Yes, I was there, yes, I knew what was going on," and then be subject to cross-examination about basically saying that he was there at the scene of the crime? I don't think he would do that. And additionally, I doubt if he would do that simply because he would want to save the impact of any type of CD recording.
They did mention the idea of immunity. Would that be something? They did mention, I think, immunity, or at least if they didn't, I sort of read that into the briefs. Would that be?
I guess that would be a possibility, but I think it would be highly unlikely simply because that wasn't the evidence that the state had adduced. That wasn't the evidence that the state was trying to present. So to give someone that they thought eyewitness had stabbed immunity for prosecution, just so that he could testify against Walton, I don't think it would have been a very sound decision that the state would have made.
If a new trial was ordered, would the state now be able to change its theory and charge, prosecute Mr. Walton as the principal rather than as an accomplice, contrary to the original theory? And bring in Mr. Elchilder to testify?
I guess it would be possible. Mr. Elchilder is currently incarcerated. Perhaps he would want to do that. But I think that the state has a duty of a burden of showing that it's fair. And then how can the state go against the evidence that its own investigators and its own prosecutor found to be the case and turn around and say, "Oh, we're going to disregard this now, and we're going to shift gears just because we want to prosecute Mr. Walton"? I don't think that would be the case.
Well, the state argued that statement, that out-of-court statement, was unreliable in the first place. So since that out-of-court statement would have been consistent, even if he testified, I'm not sure how that could occur. I mean, aren't they sort of locked in?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. To the extent, well, if Your Honor is saying that they're locked in because they went ahead with, and I think this goes to the issue of the Bruton question. On one hand, the state is saying for example, this isn't a Bruton issue because we didn't present the evidence. And yet, if in fact they decided to do that, then they become the proponent of the evidence. I think that certainly implicates Bruton in spirit, if not in actual fact.
No, but didn't the state here actively impeach the sort of or cast doubt on the legitimacy of the tape. It argued it was scripted, rehearsed, highly suspect.
That's correct.
And reeks with suspicion. And isn't it a requirement, if it's coming in as a statement against interest, that there be corroborating circumstances?
That's correct, Your Honor. And in this case, there were no... I think the test is that you're talking about Hawaii Rule of Evidence 804B3. And we believe that it was erroneously admitted pursuant to that rule, which sets forth the hearsay exceptions for a statement against interest. I might point out that it states that a statement tending to expose the declarant to criminal liability and offer to exculpate the accused is not admissible unless corroborating circumstances clearly indicate the trustworthiness of the statement. In states and in State versus Bates, for example, which is a 1989 case of this court, this court cited the commentary to strongly caution that there's a good reason for the corroboration requirement. That is, quote, a distrust of evidence of confessions by third persons offered to exculpate the accused arising from suspicion of fabrication, either of the fact of the making or in its contents. I think this demonstrates that particular reason for caution in this particular case.
How long was that tape? I mean, how much? What really concerned me was the gap where he says, well, I turned it off because I wanted to save the tape or something because it was unimportant. That really concerned me. How long could have been taped and how long was taped? And
we really don't know, Your Honor, because Mr. Elkshoulder claimed that it was made on one occasion, and yet we don't know if that was the case, whether or not there was more than one telephone call, because this was done by telephone call. Whether or not he had talked to Mr. Walton first and then had a phone call and then called him again and turned on the tape. We really don't know.
How long was the tape that was actually admitted?
Your Honor, I don't know the exact length, but it was definitely a lot longer than the CD that was presented as evidence in this particular case. And again, it was edited by the attorney for Mr. Elkshoulder. And we might point out that
didn't he represent, at least to the court, that he didn't do anything with the tape. He just took it down to, I guess, these people who do that kind of thing, and they were the ones who transferred the material from the cassette to the CD.
Well, that just talks about one issue that is raised by the fact that the attorney basically made some type of a limited proffer about what had been done, which I think we had raised the issue of whether or not that waived his right to attorney-client privilege for us to then inquire, well, you did that, but what else did you do? Did you talk to the defendant about how you were supposed to set up the tape?
I'm sort of interested in that issue of the right of confrontation and the right to cross-examine. So what specifically were you thinking of getting out of the attorney if the attorney were required to testify?
Well, there may be foundational issues. Maybe there that would raise questions about the trustworthiness of the tape. For example, as stated in Rule 804B3, at least in the commentary, that you know there is a real danger of fabrication, either by Mr. Elkshoulder or by I wouldn't say the attorney, but certainly that might lead to more information about what Elkshoulder did or didn't do, and that goes to the direct foundation of whether or not the tape was trustworthy enough to be admitted into evidence. And for example, the tape was between Elkshoulder and Walton, and clearly they both knew each other. They were friends. They were buddies. Elkshoulder usually took the lead, told Walton what to do when they were working for HMSA. The statements in the tape were in direct opposition to the evidence on the record
on retrial, if there's retrial, would the same privilege be able to be asserted if the tape were attempted to be introduced into evidence?
I think that would be for the court to answer. I would suggest not. If the tape were to be submitted into evidence, I believe that due process and the right to confrontation should allow inquiry of both Mr. Walton and Mr. Altshuler and his attorney as to what transpired in the making of the tape. Maybe going into the issue of how long it was and how many days it took.
Putting aside, I mean, there is the confrontation issue, of course, which can trump the evidence rules. But even under the evidence rules, wasn't it Altshuler? He was the one who said, I got the tape from my lawyer, right? He said something like that. That's where he'd gotten the blank tape from the lawyer.
I believe that's the case, Your Honor.
And Rule 11, 511 says if you disclose or consent to a part of something, then you waive it. And as he opened it up. Okay.
You're saying that the lawyer waived any privilege because
the client did. The client gets on the stand and starts talking about discussions he's had with his lawyer and how he got the tape and the arrangements and picks it up. And then all of a sudden, the government's... You're cut off and the government's cut off from cross-examining him?
That's correct, Your Honor. You're absolutely right. The confrontation issue, it's a constitutional right. Clearly, we had a right to cross-examine something about something that was so vital to the case in terms of Mr. Walton being convicted of attempted murder. I think that certainly indicates that he was denied the right to a fair trial. As we pointed out, the fact that Walton was sort of the follower and Altshuler was the leader is corroborated by the fact that all of the testimony, at least by one person that they worked with, indicated that was the case, that Altshuler was the older guy. He told Walton what to do. So clearly, there's an issue about whether or not Altshuler told Walton what to do because, as pointed out in the briefs, this was a year after the fact. It wasn't contemporaneous with what had occurred. There was a motive to fabricate, I guess, because Altshuler might have certainly encouraged Walton because Walton was far away. He was on the mainland. Where nobody knew where he was at that time, and the nature of the recording again directly contradicted what the evidence was, and we might point out that there's some issue as to whether or not how alert. For all we know, Walton was. If you take a listen to the tape, it sounds like he may have been under the influence, for example. That's certainly one thing that could have occurred, or that he was under a lot of mental stress. So again, this raises the issue about whether or not the trustworthiness prong of 804B3 was satisfied.
But there was cross-examination allowed on those issues regarding did he appear to be intoxicated, did he appear to be under stress at the time of the call?
There was cross-examination. I don't know whether or not there was actual questions about that. I don't recall that.
But it wasn't precluded.
It was not precluded, Your Honor. That's correct. It was not precluded. But again, whether or not it was precluded, the facts speak for themselves. This tape speaks for itself. Again, it's an indication that the trustworthiness of the tape is severely in doubt. Now, And when I say that when we submit that the conversation on the tape directly contradicts what the evidence was, not only by the prosecution but Altshuler's own testimony. For example, he said, "Well, when I saw Walton, this was in the taxi. When I saw Walton jump on the taxi." He got out of the car and walked away. And I turned around and I saw what appeared to be the car shaking and own testimony that he didn't see what was going on. And yet on the tape, he says, quote, yeah, but man, that dude had blood all over him, man. I ain't kidding you. I mean, that's the type of statement that would indicate that was, not only was he in the car, but he was probably the guy that saw all the blood because he was the one that was doing the stabbing. So I think that that's another indication as to why there's a real question about the trustworthiness of the tape. Now, Your Honor, we would also...
So what would the remedy be for something like that, then?
Well, first of all, the tape should not have...
So are you saying there should have been a 104 hearing? Wasn't there a 104 hearing?
Yes, there was, Your Honor. And I think the trial court erroneously found that that the tape should go in. And that's one of the reasons why we're here, obviously, because we believe that the trial court erred. And I think it goes beyond just discretionary. It goes to an error of law because it was so clearly erroneous.
Was Mr. Harada questioned at that hearing, and if not, should he have been in your view?
Mr. Harada asserted the attorney-client privilege, if I recall, and basically the judge went along with him, basically saying that that he should not be questioned, nor should his client be questioned about any communications between the two of them, and that obviously is an issue that we feel violates the petitioner's right to confrontation. Now, and that's because obviously we argue that that both Mr. Harada and Elkshoulder were potential witnesses, and because they were not cross-examined, not only do we feel that there was a confrontation issue, we feel that it was an evidentiary issue. How can you have something admitted when the principles to the tape cannot be asked questions about it? There's certainly an issue about completeness in terms of, you know, if you're going to have a hearing about the admissibility of the tape, then certainly shouldn't you be able to ask the participants of that particular tape what happened. And I think that goes obviously a confrontation issue, but also we would think an evidentiary issue.
I think that's subsumed in the issue, but did you ever raise that, the completeness requirement?
No, I don't believe we did, Your Honor. Things were moving very quickly at that time, it may have been raised, but I don't recall that it was. But certainly, I think that is something that should be taken into consideration. So, Your Honor, we believe that Mr. Walton was denied a fair trial for all of these reasons. The fact that there was a confrontation issue, the fact that Mr. Walton was basically denied his right to a fair trial because of the fact that the CD recording, and the point is this, the CD recording, if you listen to it, is really, I guess, very horrific in the sense that there's a lot of emotion, there's a lot of angst, there's a lot of, even a little bit of crying. So for the jury to get that particular CD, take it into the jury room and play it over and over again, which I assume that they did, gave it an undue weight in the deliberations of the jury. Now,
well, counsel, if it's admissible, then they're allowed to listen to it as many times as they want.
Right,
and if it's inadmissible, then it shouldn't go in. I'm not sure the fact that how many times they... speculation on how many times they might have listened to it.
Well, they certainly listened to it more than one time, I would submit, Your Honor. And the point is that in State versus Robinson, well, the court did say that if it's admissible, it should go in. I think that the court in Robinson carved out an exception, or at least had some thoughts about areas in which this would not be allowed to happen. And for example, in Robinson, they relied upon the Colorado line of cases, among others, which said that, okay, you can do it once it's admissible because, you know, it was a voluntary confession. And the cases cited in Robinson, for example, State versus Miller, for example, the facts were that the police questioned the defendant in a non-coercive atmosphere. He was in the hospital resting.
Did you argue non-voluntariness?
I don't recall that we did, Your Honor. I don't think that we reached that particular issue. But the point would be that the facts of allowing a tape in usually is because it was the police conducted a legitimate interrogation. Miller, for example, they gave him Miranda rights. He waived it for the Colorado courts. He wasn't in custody or under arrest. So all of the penalty of protections for someone giving a statement or a confession, were in place. So I see that my time is up. So
can I just ask you one question?
Sure.
Why wasn't this reduced to a transcript? Was there any effort or thought of
Your Honor,
doing it?
I can only submit that there was an effort to do it. Mr. Parada, we're in the middle of trial. Apparently all of this was coming up, and there was a big discussion about whether or not any of it should go in. So I guess given the nature of the flow of the trial, the judge felt that it wasn't necessary to reduce it to a transcript. So it wasn't.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kwana. Now we'll hear from Mr. Tsushima.
May it please the Court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Stephen Tsushima on behalf of the State of Hawaii. Good morning, Chief Justice.
Good morning.
And Associate Justices. When there are multiple issues before this Court, as there is in this case, what I try to do is try to determine which issue or issues this Court might be most interested in discussing. Of the six issues before this Court, I had determined that it was possibly the severance issue and the issue with regard to the tape recorded statement between defendant and co-defendant El Schroeder as it related to the joint trial. Of course, if the Court is interested in any of the other subjects or issues, please interrupt me as my discussion will primarily focus on those two issues otherwise. Now, in this case, with regard to the severance of trial, defendant was not denied a fair trial. As Gaspar, a case cited by both parties, noted, there's three possible situations where a defendant is denied a fair trial. The first, as counsel had brought up, is where there's an irreconcilable conflict between the defenses, and that conflict alone led the jury to believe that the defendant was guilty. So it's a two-part test. Now, as to the first part, whether there is an irreconcilable conflict, we agree with the ICA's conclusion that there was a conflict to some degree. That is in contrast to the position I took in my answering brief, where I argued that there was not conflict. In preparing for this oral argument and looking at the defenses as they're presented, as well as the state's closing argument, I would submit that there was some conflict to some degree between the defenses. But what's important is to look at the second part of the test, which is whether that conflict alone led the jury to believe that the defendant was guilty. And what that second part of the test inevitably calls for this Court to look at is the evidence as it was presented, as well as the strength of the evidence against the defendant. And in this case, the evidence was strong to connect defendant to the offense of attempted murder, as well as the robbery charge. Of course, that robbery charge ultimately was, he was only convicted of the attempted murder charge.
It merged.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
No problem.
The second part of the test is whether the defendant in question was prevented in introducing evidence. That issue, I don't believe defendant even raised as one of the things that she was denied. And the third part is whether evidence damaging to the defendant in question admitted would not have been admissible in the defendant's separate trial. And I believe that's where it ties in with the tape-recorded conversation between defendant and defendant, co-defendant Elkshoulder. Defendant clearly argues, and as he's argued this morning, is that that would not have been admitted in a separate trial. And he brought up the theory of the case, the state's theory of the case, but as I'm sure this court is well aware, that was the prosecutor's theory of the case in this case. Five prosecutors on the same evidence could have different theories of the case. It's a take on the evidence. That is what a theory of the case is. That can, so it can differ from prosecutor to prosecutor what a theory of the case is. Certainly, the theory of the case will change whether it's a joint trial of defendants or whether it's a separate trial of defendants. So defendant's argument that the theory of the case could not change isn't true. It absolutely changes depending on the evidence and the way it's presented at trial. And certainly, the way the evidence is going to be presented in a joint trial, theory of the case will have to shift and adapt to what you're dealing with in a joint trial as opposed to a separate trial where your focus is simply on defendant.
Why aren't these defenses mutually exclusive?
I actually do think they are mutually exclusive because they are pointing the finger at each other and saying, I am conceding that there is a conflict in the defenses. But I'm turning to the second part of the test.
But I'm glad you're acknowledging that, but I mean, if these defenses are mutually exclusive, and I think I agree with you, because if you believe Elkshoulder, then Elkshoulder is going to be acquitted, as he was, of the charge and found guilty of a lesser, and his co-defendant's going to be found guilty as charged, which is what happened. And under at least Ninth Circuit precedent, once you have that, a severance is required.
Well, I think you still have to look at the second part of the test, whether that conflict alone is what caused the jury to believe that the defendant was guilty. I think it's a two-part test under Gaspar. The first is whether there's conflict, and I'm conceding there is conflict. But I think what this court is forced to look at and must look at is the evidence as it was presented and whether it's that conflict alone that led the jury to believe that defendant was guilty. And it's not. There's
I'm not sure how that conflict alone would lead the jury to find the defendant guilty. Because I think you'd have to assume number three would apply, right?
I assume that number three is what they're raising, but that it does not apply in this case.
Right.
How about the conflict plus the tape together?
Yes, that's where my argument, I guess, focuses on, is whether there was whether a defendant was denied a fair trial because the tape was brought in. And my point, where I was going with that, is what I raised in my brief, was that...
So the state argued at trial that this tape was scripted, rehearsed, highly suspect, and reeks with suspicion. Are you suggesting today that another prosecutor would have put that tape forward as a statement against interest and argue that, in fact, the tape was credible?
In a separate trial?
Yes.
Not only another trial, another prosecutor. I believe this prosecutor would have brought it in a separate trial because the focus is specifically on the defendant, on just defendant.
I understand you can have different theories of a case, but when you're getting to the point of suggesting that evidence is actually tainted, and you're telling me the prosecutor might come forward and put forth tainted evidence, that a fellow prosecutor felt was tainted.
And again, I would submit this prosecutor would have done it. It's not that it's tainted. It's a take on the evidence because he didn't suggest that the...
Tainted's a strong word, but reeks with suspicion is a strong phrase, too.
It is. And that's his take of how the weight of the evidence should be dealt. He was arguing it as to admissibility, but the arguments he was actually making was as to weight because he never said that the people on the recording is suspicious whether it's defendant or co-defendant Elkshoulder. In fact, what he represented to counsel was that he played the tape recorder for the state's witnesses, the two HMSA employees who were co-workers, and they confirmed by the voices as well as the content of what they're discussing that it was indeed defendant and co-defendant Elkshoulder. So the deputy, in this case, did not take the position that the evidence was not what it purported to be, but rather just that the weight should not be given to the evidence under the circumstances upon which it was made.
The implication being it was contrived or it had been it was a staged confession, I guess.
That was his theory of the case in the joint trial. But I believe any experienced felony deputy taking this case separately would take a different take of the evidence if it was a separate trial and the focus was clearly on defendant.
So if the motion for severance had been granted, would this tape have been used against Mr. Walton?
Absolutely, yes. Because
What if he went to trial first?
That would be one circumstance where there would be a difficulty, but still, I believe the state would have had an opportunity to try to lay the foundation through the HMSA co-workers in being able to identify the voices as being defendant and defendant Coda Schroeder, based not just on their knowledge of their voices, of knowing them, seeing them on a daily basis, interacting with them for several months, but also as to the content of what was said that only a defendant, co-defendant Elkshorter, would know that the material that's being discussed.
You're saying that this tape could have come in just through these people, not someone that was actually on the phone call and recording it?
I believe the state could have tried to lay a foundation that way, but the other two...
Excuse me, are you saying that, I want to make sure I heard this, you're saying that if Walton had gotten to trial first, prosecutor would have tried to utilize his tape?
Absolutely.
Not through Elkshorter.
How then could they have had a different theory with Mr. Walton? What are they going to do? The government is one. Government can't change its position no matter who the assigned prosecutor. They can't come in with one theory saying this guy did the stabbing and then come back later and say another guy did the stabbing.
Well, it's not going that far as to changing who did the stabbing. In fact, it's just...
It does.
No, it doesn't, actually, Your Honor. And one of the pieces of evidence I want to point out, huge difference between whether the victim absolutely said co-defendant Elkshorter did all the stabbing. He did not say that. When he testified, he said co-defendant Elkshorter was the first one that did the stabbing. When he was gave further testimony, he made it absolutely clear the stabbings that proceeded after that, the three or four stabbings, another hand came in. He's not sure who it was. He did not know who it was that committed the three or four other stabbings. It's on page 61, 113, and 115 of his testimony.
In my years with your office, I've never seen your office do something like that, and I'm glad I've never seen them do something like that.
It's just a different take on the evidence, Justice. It's not anything unethical or untoward in looking at the evidence in a different manner.
So you're saying if there's a retrial, you're going to go back and the new prosecutor is going to argue that this tape is very reliable and should be admitted?
I would hope so. I would hope so.
Your position is that the state would not be judicially stopped from making that argument at this time?
I don't believe it should be. I couldn't emphasize more that it's just a take on the evidence of what.
So it doesn't really matter what a prosecutor says then. The state can just blow hot and cold. It's not reliable. You know what? We changed it, our mind. It is reliable.
No, I don't believe it is that. And it's, I don't know how to make it more clear for this court, but it happens all the time in the office where we are discussing, three prosecutors will be discussing the same evidence, and there will be an absolutely different theory of the case of what the evidence
shows. I understand,
shows,
but once you go to court and make a representation, you're saying that a different prosecutor can come in and just totally change it.
Well, because of what the evidence here showed, it wasn't that co-defendant Elkshorter did all the stabbing. The evidence actually showed that co-defendant...
I understand. You argued. The closing argument was that there was evidence that both defendants did the stabbing. All we're talking about is the tape, right?
Correct. And I believe even as to the tape, this prosecutor's closing argument pointed out that he found there it was full of deception and that there's just reason to suspicion. He did say, however, this jury could find it to be believable. If it is, then defendant could be found guilty as a principal. He did say that. He didn't abandon that position at all. It was not, I admit, it was not the focus of his theory of the case. His focus of the theory of the case was as an accomplice. However, what the jury's verdict seems to indicate is that it didn't buy this prosecutor's closing argument, because as the verdict showed, they found defendant guilty.
So therefore, Mr. Walton was prejudiced by the denial of the motion to sever.
No, he was
because
not.
He was convicted on the co-defendant's theory of the case, not on the state's theory of the case.
No, because that evidence would have come in a separate trial as well.
But there wouldn't have been two accusers in one case. They wouldn't have been. Mr. Walton had two different people, two different entities that were accusing him. Mm-hmm. That's why we have severance, so that doesn't occur.
But in this case, he actually benefited from the state's, well, he could have benefited from the state's position because the state's position was that it was deception and suspicion. In a separate trial, I have to believe a prosecutor wouldn't argue the evidence that way, would argue it simply as what it was. It was a admission to the three or four stab wounds which otherwise aren't accounted for, which the victim says he was stabbed those multiple times, but he could not indicate which of the two individuals had committed those stabbings.
So it benefits him during opening and closing argument to have two people, two different parties accusing him?
It benefited him that, or it could have benefited him in that the state was saying this is full of deception, but the jury didn't believe that. The jury looked at it and said, no, I believe that's an admission.
Well, actually, it was Walton who benefited, right?
It was Walton
who benefited because the prosecution and I guess Walton were saying Elk showed it. But wasn't the prosecution's theory was that Elk shoulder did it? So that benefits Walton.
Did the first stab? Yes.
Well, I mean that's the whole theory.
Right.
So when we look at severance, are we looking at what was actually admitted, or are we looking at what would be admissible?
We're looking at what was actually admitted.
Be admitted?
Severance,
that decision has to be made before trial.
Correct.
So in that calculus, would we be then trying to determine whether that tape would be admissible in order to determine the severance issue on the third ground?
Yes, that is one of the third, yeah, correct. That is the third problem. And of course, the trial court, not only pre-trial could have looked at it, but during the trial, once the evidence is admitted, defendant could have raised it again, his issue of severance, but he had not raised that issue during trial.
Okay, the rule says the court can ask for severance of counts or fashion other relief. So what could the court have done in this trial?
If he had raised it during trial?
To prevent prejudice.
To prevent what prejudice?
Prejudice to Walton.
Which prejudice is that? That the court's referring to the tape coming in?
Because so you have no other theories about how the court could have issued an order during the trial that would have prevented prejudice to Walton?
I believe two juries could have been called to hear the evidence separately as to defendant and as to co-defendant, but I don't believe counsel raised that as a possible remedy requested that as one of the remedies that he wanted. But he did not, the point I was trying to make was that he did not raise the issue further at the close of the state's evidence or at the close of all of the evidence that there should have been a separate.
If the state were to put this tape into evidence, wouldn't the state have to provide evidence of the production of the CD? In other words, go through all the steps of how the cassette was, or the information on the cassette was transferred to the CD, and what was done, and who did it, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And so why wasn't that allowed in this case? Why wasn't questioning on that allowed in this case?
The question as to how that occurred, or why didn't the state bring it?
Went from the cassette to the CD, and what the process was, and who did it. That evidence was not allowed, or the questioning on that was not allowed in this case.
Yes.
So why if you would have to prove it, why wouldn't the that questioning have been allowed in this particular case?
I believe the questioning was allowed. What the questioning was not allowed was specifically the...
I don't recall if there was any evidence, and I thought that was the reason why the defense wanted to question the attorney, because the attorney was the one who took the tape to the people who transferred it and went through the production. But none of those people were ever called to testify, and none of that process was ever allowed to be questioned, or at least... disclosed or discussed.
I don't.
Well,
I disagree because I believe the record showed that the court did allow co-counsel to question defendant. What I'm reading from my notes that with regard to the purpose, motive, and the various copies of the tape.
Right, so but your point was that on a separate in a separate trial, the state might be able to authenticate the tape by having the co-workers recognize the voices. How would the state be able to authenticate the production of the tape, that it was captured in a way that was accurate, the recording was accurate?
Had there been a separate trial?
Yes.
I believe there would be difficulties, and I think I raised in my brief that, of course, we'd have to speculate as to what the occurrences is would have been, but certainly if co-defendant Elkshoulder trial had gone first, we could have laid the foundation through co-defendant Elkshoulder.
How could Elkshoulder lay the foundation if he wasn't the one who did it? And how do we know how competent the people were who did the transfer?
I guess there would have to have been further investigation into the recording of the tape and the transcript.
I guess what I'm saying is if you would be required to do that in a separate trial, then why wasn't that allowed in this trial?
Again, I think there was, it just wasn't pursued by defense for...
It was pursued. It was pursued in their request to question the attorney.
And right. Didn't you also want to question the attorney, right? Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And what was denied was the just the interaction between defendant and counsel. That's what was denied by the court, not for this development of how the process was made or which people were involved in the cleaning up process. I think what was settled during the discussions was that, in fact, if I remember right, counsel for defendant Elkshoulder had offered in a 104 hearing to clear up any matters that they might have, but that was never followed up on by defense counsel. He had said that he would do a tell-all circumstances if the court found it necessary, but the counsel never followed up on that or said, yes, that's what I want to do. It just seemed a very kind of unclear challenge as to what he wanted to find out, which occurred as far as the interaction between counsel and defendant Elkshoulder. What information was he trying to pull out from that conversation between the two of them? And that, the attorney-client privilege conversations was the only thing from my reading of record that the circuit court was denying. It wasn't denying cross-examination of Elkshoulder as to other circumstances regarding the recording of the conversation or the people that he took it to or calling those witnesses to testify in a 104 hearing to determine the circumstances of the upon which the recording was made. And there was, as far as I recall, no challenges with regard to their reliability or what's indeed on the recordings itself. Now, looking at my notes, I believe I've made the points I wanted to make, so unless the court has further questions.
There being no further questions, thank you very much, Mr. Tsushima. Mr. Kawana, your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I think the issue of changing position by the prosecution is something that has to be taken very seriously by this court. Members of the court have highlighted this issue to say that the prosecution takes a we stand about what occurred, and we, for example, and we think that there is this tape recording is suspect, then certainly I think it would pervert the notion of justice if next time around they reverse their position and say, oh, this tape is great, we're going to use it as evidence. I think that is something that should not be allowed. Certainly, the defendant should not be convicted, as happened in this case, where he was subject to not only the state's theory of the case, but the other defendant's theory of the case, so that not only were there irreconcilable defenses, there were irreconcilable theories of what had occurred, again, leading to the result that the trial should have been severed. And I think there was an issue of judicial estoppel from changing position, going beyond any type of constitutional issue. So we would submit, we pointed out in our briefs that this motion to sever was made not only pre-trial, but orally also during the course of trial when some of these issues started coming up. And they were, of course, all denied by the court.
Would the ability or the opportunity for the defense to test the copy of the recording be a substitute for the right to confrontation?
Well, to test the validity of the recording can only be done by actually being able to examine not only the witness about his...
Well, I thought during trial the argument was made that, well, you had the right to test the copy, so, and you never raised anything, so... That sort of satisfies the objection that you couldn't cross-examine the attorney.
Well, no, Your Honor. I think we raised the objection as to the whether or not the foundation was established, and I think Your Honor pointed out correctly that if the prosecution, if they were going to admit evidence such as this on their own, would have had to establish a foundation, but this was sort of glossed over by the court in allowing the CD recording to come in. So there was no effort made, and we did object, I believe, to the foundational issues as to how these were done. And even if there were attempts at cross-examination, certainly I think the burden was upon both the state as well as the co-defendant to establish those foundational issues. So, Your Honor, we would, and with respect to the authentication of the CD recording, there would be no way in which the co-workers, even if they could testify about the fact that these were two people that whose voices they recognized, whether or not that would satisfy whether or not this tape was authentic, not only with respect to the people who were talking on the phone, but also whether it was in fact something that was fabricated or made up. So we would submit that, again, there are a number of issues here which the court may find some more stronger than others, but I think taken in the totality of it all, there all of these little cuts about how these evidentiary issues were resolved, how severance was resolved, that taken in totality, even if the court doesn't agree that some of them are stronger than others, I think taken in totality, they demonstrate that Mr. Walton was not given a fair trial. But I think the proof of the pudding, of course, is the fact that that he was convicted of...
need to wrap up, Mr. Kwan. I'm sorry, but no, you may. You can finish your thought, but I just... I was giving you a few extra moments, but it's...
You got carried away. So we would submit that, in this case, the conviction should be reversed. The decision of the ICA should be reversed, and Mr. Walton should have another chance. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both of our attorneys today. The court will take this matter under advisement.